Vermont Viewpoint is a public affairs program produced and funded by WDEV and the Radio Vermont Group. We welcome listener feedback. Email your comments to vtviewpoint@radiovermont.com.
Good morning. This is Vermont Viewpoint on WDEV. I'm Rick Sengary. Next hour, we'll be discussing solar batteries and energy storage, and then we'll learn about Vermont after school. But this hour, it's all about the birds. If you haven't noticed, some of them are already on the wing, heading in a southerly direction. So this is the perfect time to learn why birds migrate, why different birds migrate at different times. And we'll also discuss what you can do to actually help those birds as they take on this massive trek. With us to educate us and answer all of your questions is Audubon Vermont conservation biologist Margaret Fowle. Margaret, welcome to Vermont Viewpoint.
Hi, Rick. How are you?
I'm great. How are you doing?
Pretty good.
Good. And we also have Kira Fagan, Environmental Education and Outreach AmeriCorps member. Kira, thank you for joining us and sharing your knowledge as well.
Good morning, Rick.
Morning. Listeners, if you'd like to ask our guests a question about bird migration, or if you want to let us know what you're seeing, you can give us a call, 244-1777, 877-291-TALK. That's 877-291-8255. And the email address is vtviewpoint@radiovermont.com. All right, Margaret. Why do some birds migrate while others like to hang around where they've been, you know, for the rest of the year?
Well, it's really dependent on what the birds eat. So the ones that are 100% dependent on insects for food, they need to leave Vermont. They need to go south in order to find food and to survive. It's not 100% understood why some go quite so far. You know, some go as far as South America to find food. But it probably has to do with the habitats they find, the nutrition they find, the, you know, competition they might have for food elsewhere. So the insect eaters tend to be the ones that fly the furthest, the ones who can survive on seeds or even rodents and things like that tend to be the ones who don't fly quite as far.
All right, so we're going to talk a lot about those that migrate today, but what birds decide that they can stay put and live here every winter?
Well, so we've got a lot of birds, what I would call bird feeder birds, that stay all winter. So birds like black-capped chickadee, which is often at a bird feeder eating seed. American goldfinch will stick around. But even some other birds that eat berries will stay as well. So American robin, even though during the summer they eat worms and things like that, they are able to stay in Vermont if they can find enough berries. So they switch their diet over in the winter.
Now, Kira, do all birds have the alarm clock go off inside their heads at the same time and start migrating? Or do those, you know, farthest north get shifting south first? How does it work with birds? Who goes when?
So not all birds are going to migrate at the same time. Again, like Margaret was saying, it has to do with what their food sources are and what food sources are starting to change earlier. So it will depend especially, too, on, like, climate and if we are having longer summers now and warmer weather is lasting longer and insects are going to be out more. And then, of course, as climate has been changing and cold snaps are coming faster and there's, like, more of an immediate change, like you'll have a warm day and then all of a sudden plants are dying and bugs are dead within a week. That's going to affect, like, birds staying longer and then suddenly being left with short food sources as well.
And, Kira, what do you enjoy about the fall migration?
I just think it's so exciting to get to see so many more birds and so much more activity. One of my favorite parts of fall migration, especially, is getting to see hawks migrate. And broad-winged hawks are one of the most exciting migrations to Washington, I think. And Mount Philo has always been a great place for watching hawk migration and getting to see kettling, which is when those birds will all kind of circle together in the sky above you at just, like, massive quantities.
Margaret, we think of, you know, birds migrating south. Are we the southern edge of migration for any particular birds?
We are, actually. We have birds that migrate from the Arctic and can often spend the winter here. So snowy owl is one that often comes down from the tundra and spends winter here. There's sort of a cycle, so that it depends on the food resources up north for snowies or how many young have been produced and how much competition there is. But we'll sometimes have winters where we have several snowy owls. And then we also have some species that we call eruptive species, so they'll come down from way north and spend the winter, and those seem to also go on cycles depending on food resources. Some of those are feeder birds, like the common red pole, which will come to people's feeders. Seems to be related to their, they are a seed eater, so they depend, and they will tend to eat cone seeds, so on spruce fir cones, and that, so if there's a shortage of cones up north, they'll come down to Vermont and spend the winter here, and often see them in feeders. So there's several species like that that will end up here in the winter, coming down from further north.
Our numbers, listeners, are 244-1777 and 877-291-8255. Let's go to the phones. We've got Fred joining us from Newbury. Hi, Fred.
Morning.
Morning.
Let's see here. Does barometric pressure have anything to do with the timing of when a migration is going to start? And does barometric pressure have anything to do with the day they might start to migrate? And the other question is, angle of the sun. Does that have anything to do with it?
All right, Fred, thanks for your questions. I'm not sure who wants to handle that one. Barometric pressure, angle of the sun, how much or what does it have to do with the fall bird migration?
Well, I'm happy to start, and Kira, okay, you can add to what I say. So birds have a number of what we call cues that help them sort of decide when to migrate. So barometric pressure can be one. I don't think it's the angle of the sun, but it's the amount of daylight. So, you know, birds migrate at different times of the day. So hawks, which what's so fun about hawk migration is you can see it during the day, but actually most songbirds migrate at night. So what they, some of the cues that give them the indication to migrate at night are the wind, the weather, and so if it's stormy and cloudy and the wind is from the south, they're not going to migrate at night, but they're using the stars to orient themselves. Whereas, say, a broadwing is using probably landmarks to orient itself, so rivers and mountain ranges, and they need a clear day as well, and they're not going to migrate on a stormy day. So I'm sure that, and some birds actually use magnetic fields to help orient themselves. So I'm sure barometric pressure plays a role in helping them decide when to migrate. And when we get a really bad storm, sometimes birds that are from don't typically migrate through Vermont end up in Vermont because they get blown off course. So something disrupts their ability to orient.
We like that. We get to see birds we don't normally see. Kira, anything to add to answer Fred's question?
Well, just something I wanted to note on what Margaret was saying about migrating at night, too, is something that we see that's affecting changes in migrating at night is levels of light pollution. And so especially as birds are migrating through areas that might be more populated in bigger cities where those cities might be lit up more at night, that's going to affect their ability to orient themselves and their ability to read their own cues. And if they're orienting by stars or something like that, light pollution is going to get in the way of that. And that also feels like a really good plug for a resource that I like to look at to track bird migration, which is birdcast.info. And that's from the Cornell Lab of Ornithology. And it's a really great resource for watching bird migration forecast maps and seeing that nocturnal migration happen.
Wow. And that's birdcast.info.
Birdcast.info. birdcast.info, yes.
Okay, great. Margaret, Kira mentioned earlier Mount Philo is a great place to see hawks during the migration. Do you have specific locations at this time of year to observe the migration, maybe see specific birds?
Yeah, so there are lots of places you can go. If you're interested in hawk migration, any sort of high elevation area in the Champlain Valley is great. So Mount Philo is great because it's easy to get to the top, and you have a beautiful view. Snake Mountain is another good one. Down at Putney Mountain is a very popular migration, hawk migration location. But if you're looking for songbirds migrating, the best place is just to, well, the best time is to wait for, you know, look at the forecast on the BirdCast migration map, which right now is pretty at a pretty high level for our region. So a lot of birds are moving through. And when you get a cloudy day like this, a lot of these birds drop down and feed and try to, you know, fill up their resource, you know, eat seeds, eat bugs, whatever they can find. So right now, if you're out and about in the woods or in the shrubby areas, you can see a lot of these migrants who are feeding. Right now at my house, I've got hermit thrushes that have stopped, white-throated sparrows, and they're not as long-distance migrants as some of the warblers that have already left. A lot of the warblers have already left, but I did see a warbler yesterday, a yellow-rumped warbler. So a lot of birds are sort of stopping over and fueling up for the next leg of their journey.
Mm. Kira, I'm that person who can drive, you know, a good 9-10 hours a day. But let's talk about what birds do when they're migrating. First of all, how long will they fly during the course of a day when they're migrating?
So that really depends on what's going on with the weather, how much food they were able to eat beforehand, and also, like, a lot of times they'll migrate all together, and so there's a lot of factors that are going into that. Wind is a big thing, too, but especially for songbirds that are migrating through the night, that will be, like, a full night flight, and so they can really travel for long, extended periods of time at a time.
Mm. And then generally, you give us a range of how long it does take a typical bird to reach their southern destination.
That might be a better question for Margaret.
Okay. Sure.
Well, I think it's like Kira said, it depends on the bird. But I'm thinking of an example here. Broad-winged hawks, they migrate pretty far. They go to South America, northern South America, which is like an average of 4,000 or so miles. And they'll travel, and this is a daytime migrant, so they're going to travel. People have put transmitters on them, so they know kind of what their travel patterns on are. And they travel about 70 miles a day. Whereas in contrast, so that seems like 70 miles a day for us seems like no big deal in a car. Mm-hmm. But for a broadwing, you know, they're soaring a lot of that distance, but they're also flapping, and it takes a lot of energy. But then in contrast, hummingbirds, which go to Central and South America, can do their migration in just a matter of a few days. So it really depends on the species, and it depends on their migratory habits.
I would probably pick the shortest trip I possibly could. I'm a lazy bird, you know, and say, let's get down there maybe to North or South Carolina. It's warm. I'm fine. But I don't think that's the way it works. You've mentioned some, Margaret, who have, fly great distances. You just mentioned the hummingbird. What do the chimney swifts do?
So they go pretty far. So they go as far as the Amazon in Peru, northern Chile, that sort of area. And they're actually really amazing because they tend not to stop over. A lot of swifts, and I'm not actually sure if the chimney swift can do this, but a lot of swifts can actually turn off half their brain and sleep in flight. So half the brain is sleeping while the other half is awake. And that way they don't have to stop.
That is gold. Incredible how nature does that.
Pretty amazing.
Now, did we have a really good season for chimney swifts around here this year?
We didn't really track how successful they were, but we did track, people reported their sightings so that we have a good sense of where they are, and we're trying to work on determining the most important habitats for them throughout the state, which tend to be in urban areas where they're using chimneys and structures to either nest or what you call roost, which is kind of a stopover option for them. So in the beginning of their migration, they will find a place to kind of go in at night and rest for a little while. So like I just said, they don't really sleep while they're flying, but they do stop and rest in these roosts. So we're tracking kind of the most important places for them so that we can make sure they have the habitats they need during migration as well as for breeding.
And, Margaret, while we're talking about tracking, we love tapping into citizen science, scientists. How can people help with tracking to let people know, or to let you all know what they're seeing when and where?
Well, we have specific projects where we ask volunteers to do a lot of monitoring for us. Most of that is during the breeding season. So we have a chimney swift monitoring project where people can enter sightings onto eBird, which is a database that tracks a lot of bird sightings throughout the world, and that's a great place to enter your information. iNaturalist is another place where people like to enter information. Unfortunately, the two don't talk together, so you have to, if you want to look something up and you want to find out what birds have been moving through recently, you probably want to look at both resources. But we also have a winter eagle survey, and we do several monitoring projects during the breeding season. So less focused on migration than for us at Audubon in particular, but definitely we're doing what we can to keep track of these species that we consider to be priorities that are mostly declining or somewhat sensitive.
Kira, let's talk about our grassland bird friend, the bobolink. So what does their migration entail?
So they're one of the most impressive songbird migrants that we have coming from Vermont. They travel around like 12,000 miles to and from Southern America every year. And throughout its lifetime, it'll end up traveling the equivalent of 4 or 5 times around the circumference of the Earth. And that's another bird that's been heavily monitored in Vermont, and there's been a lot of projects through Audubon Vermont that have been able to monitor bobolinks in the area.
Now, Kira, you've interned at Audubon mm-hmm. Vermont. You're an AmeriCorps member now. Does your career involve doing something with birds?
So my career aspirations are mostly to educate about birds, and I enjoy working with children and getting to lead programs that foster this kind of relationship with nature and the outdoors, and foster really like a love for birds and conservation, and getting to learn about places that birds live. And I really like encouraging kids to notice what they're seeing in their own worlds and how that will change over time. Especially as climate change progresses, and we're going to have kids be in tune to what's happening in the natural world around them is what I'm really passionate about.
Where and when did your love for birds develop?
My grandmother is an avid birder, and so I always kind of had that little bit in my corner. And I grew up in New Jersey, which is a great state for watching birds as well.
Mm-hmm.
And then I ended up coming to UVM for environmental studies, and at UVM was able to join in a program where we took kids in the north end of Burlington birding every week, and that's really what drove my passion for birding and for being outside with children.
Outstanding. All right, Margaret, we've talked about a lot of these impressive flyers, and I don't want to slight any. Are there any birds that we should talk about that make some incredible treks?
Any other birds, you mean?
Yes.
There's just a huge number. There's several shorebird species that go really long distances. I know there's a species, world that's called the spoon-billed sandpiper that migrates in Siberia and goes all the way to China and the Himalayas. And, you know, I'm not familiar with that part of the world, but it's just a huge effort. And some of the birds, we actually have some birds, some interesting birds that actually migrate along the Lake Champlain waterway that we didn't really know were moving through until, I'd say, about 10 years ago. A great birder named Ted Murin discovered that we have these pelagic species, which are species that live on the ocean pretty much year-round that move through. So species called Jaegers and several interesting gull species move through. And we didn't know that they actually use Lake Champlain to migrate until Ted started using his amazingly strong spotting scope and watching them move across, move down from north to south along the lake without stopping. So they're, you can sometimes draw them in if you're out in a boat and you're throwing fish out the boat or some other snacks that brings other gulls in. Sometimes they'll come in and be attracted to it and try to steal the food from the gulls. So that's kind of a cool thing to do at this time of year.
And I ask Kira this question, Margaret, but where did your love and interest for birds stem from?
So I was always interested in nature, and believe it or not, I grew up in New York City. not my favorite place to live right now, but I had my parents and my grandparents were very nature-oriented, and when I was, after graduating from college with an art degree, I realized that I really wanted to be working with wildlife. So I got an internship at the Vermont Institute of Natural Science taking care of raptors there, injured raptors, and that's where I really fell in love with birds. And since my original sort of passion for raptors, I've expanded it to include all birds.
Oh, I love it. All right, we're going to take a break for a CBS News update, and then we'll be back for more birds with Margaret Fowle and Kira Fagan of Audubon, Vermont. Well, great time now, listeners, to join in with your questions or comments as we go to the break, 244-1777 or 877-291-8255. You can also email vtviewpoint@radiovermont.com. Speaking of birds, the Sox finish in Baltimore tonight playing the Orioles. Our coverage begins at 6:05. Game gets started at 7:05. This is Vermont Viewpoint on WDEV.
Let our staff at the Warren Store ease you back into a pre-pandemic lifestyle. We can cater your postponed events and even bake you a custom cake. We can dress you in comfortable casual clothing. Make it a day trip for the best one-stop shopping in Vermont. Have lunch on our deck, head upstairs for some much-needed retail therapy, then treat yourself to a specialty coffee from our new espresso machine. You can pick up a colorful Warren Store beach towel for a dip in the river, and how about a delicious house-made ice cream sandwich? Fun, funky, safe, and friendly. Warren Store, Main Street, Warren Village, and warrenstore.com.
Welcome back to Vermont Viewpoint. I'm Rick Singeri. In the simpler times of my youth, my parents must have loved it when it was bird migration season. Me and the kids in my neighborhood would lay on our front lawn and just stare skyward as birds flew north or south overhead. It was like a free, never-ending movie, and all those avians got our Oscar nominations. As it's fall migration time, we've got Kira Fagan and Margaret Fowle from Audubon, Vermont, helping us enjoy the movement of birds above us. Listeners, if you've got a question or a comment about what you're seeing overhead, give us a call, 244-1777, 877-291-8255. You can email vtviewpoint@radiovermont.com. All right, Kira, if I went to a great viewing spot right now, what birds would I be able to see heading through this area on their way to warmer and sunnier climes?
Well, it depends what kind of viewing spot you're trying to go to, but I think that being in the woods right now, especially given that it's a cloudier day, I think that there'd be a lot of songbirds that you'd be able to find starting their migration, especially with the cloud cover today. They're not going to be migrating as much. It's going to be harder to use their viewpoints to orient themselves, and so you might get a lot of the tail ends of the warblers heading out. And that's always an exciting part of migration for me, is getting to see warblers in the fall with their now fall plumage, which can make them a lot harder to identify. So it becomes a trickier game to play, but it's one of the best parts of migration to me.
Margaret, any that you've seen recently that you know that were definitely on their way south that you were really surprised or happy to spot?
I haven't seen anything unusual. Sometimes there are several ways to get information from birders. So you can always look at eBird, but there's also a listserv and a Facebook page, and so people often post interesting sightings. There was a species that we don't typically get that got blown off course during one of the hurricanes a few weeks ago. It's called a brown booby, which is it's a pelagic species. It's like a gannet, which is kind of a big, almost like a cormorant, but a brown booby has got a lot of brown and big webbed feet.
Yeah.
And that bird drew quite a bit of attention because they don't typically come through Vermont.
Wow, that's really exciting. Kira, I've seen from your blog on vt.audubon.org that you do have an affinity for crows. So how did that develop, and what do you like about them?
I do. My affinity for crows really grew last winter, I guess, when I kind of felt like everything was shut down. Everything was shut down. but it was hard to gather a lot of motivation to go birding last winter, even though there wasn't much else to do. It just still felt like staying in my apartment was just the best option. And so I guess the way that I best connected to birds at that time was through my window. And so I'm in Burlington, Vermont, and a lot of the city birds that we get here are crows, and especially in the winter as they're roosting, they're birds that are here year-round. So they're not really going to migrate so much as, like, change their behavioral patterns around Vermont. And in the winter, they tend to roost in what we call murders, which are large, these, like, massive groups of crows. And one of the most magical things that happens in the winters in Burlington to me is just as you'll walk through, especially I'm in the old north end of Burlington, these trees are just like, it's like the crows are the leaves of the trees at this point. These trees are just filled with these murders of crows, and they're part of the corvid family, which is one of the smartest families of birds, in my opinion. Their communication skills are amazing, and so they just really have this, like, family attitude of getting through the winter. And so last year when it kind of felt like a very isolating winter, I was like, these are my friends, and I'm going to watch them get through the winter together, and that'll get me through as well.
Oh, that's fantastic. All right, let's go back to the phones. We've got David joining us from Richmond. Hi, David. Go right ahead.
Good morning, guys. What an interesting show. Thank you. I have several questions, but the guy said I can only ask two. So here's my first one. The robins that I see nesting in my yard this year, will they migrate and be the same robins that come back to my yard next year?
All right. And your second question?
My wife and I were walking in the woods one day, and hundreds of blackbirds were migrating simultaneously. And I'm wondering, what's the signal that they send to say, all right, let's all meet in Rick's and Gary's backyard next Tuesday to start our migration. Is there anything like that, or is it what it actually makes them gather? And do they travel in a group for safety or for navigation purposes or like that?
Ah, great questions, David. All right, let's check first on the robins. Will we be seeing the same robins back here next year that we see now? And where are those robins migrating, by the way? Who's the robin person?
Go ahead, Kira, if you want to answer.
All right, Kira, go ahead.
Yeah, sure. So robins are birds that, like, especially as climate change has progressed, we've been seeing stay more and more in the winters. And I feel like although robins are a bird that are commonly associated with the start of spring and robins getting the worm, as their food sources have increased for the winter, they're more likely to be here year-round in Vermont. it is also very likely that those robins that will be there in the spring are the same robins that you have in your yard right now. Most birds return to their same nesting spots and are able to just kind of like cache that information in their brains for where to return. It really becomes a routine to all of them. So those robins are likely to be the same robins that you'll see.
All right.
Here again.
David, the Richmond robins, they're yours. They'll be hanging around and be back in the same spots year after year. Now, the blackbirds said, you know, that hundreds at a time are migrating. And how do they signal that it's time for all to start migrating? Margaret, do you want to handle that one?
Sure. I actually don't know how they communicate with each other. I mean, I know that migrating groups offers quite a bit of safety for them, you know, safety in numbers concept, by confusing predators and making it difficult to allow a predator to pick out one particular victim. But as to how they let each other know where they are and that it's time to move together, I don't have an answer for that. That's something I would have to look up. Which we could do, unless Kira knows.
I don't have an answer for that one either. I know that for me, though, red-winged blackbirds migrating are always, at least their spring migration to me is always one of my, like, false indicators for spring in Vermont, because they'll come back around end of February or in March, and then it's like, oh, it's spring, and it's not. But they are one of the first birds to return.
Yeah, they are a great, great sign of spring, although they can handle being here when it's pretty, the weather's pretty terrible.
All right, so we're not going to be fooled by those red-winged blackbirds next year. Sandal's up next from East Montpelier. Hi, Sandal.
Hi, good morning.
Morning.
And this is a great conversation to be having this time of year. Thank you.
Sure.
So, Margaret and Kira, I spotted two night hawks. Actually up in the country where we live outside of Montpelier around the 1st of September. And I know the distinctive wing bar that's underneath their wings and the long, thin silhouette of their wings. But we aren't hearing or seeing nighthawks in Montpelier anymore in the evenings, although I'm not there many nights after dark. And I'm wondering if there's still an active population in the Burlington area or where you might be having reports or sightings of nighthawks. I'll hang up and listen.
Thanks, Sandal. All right. What do we know about nighthawks in Vermont?
So nighthawks are kind of a sad story. They were a resident of Vermont. Their populations are declining pretty dramatically. And we do not know of any nesting nighthawks in the state anymore. They're now a listed species in the state. They do migrate through, and they do migrate early. So just like Sandal said, she saw them, I think she said she saw them in early September.
Yeah,
they do
September
migrate
1st.
Kind of late summer, late August, early September, and we tend to see the largest numbers moving through the Connecticut River Valley. So they're coming from the north, passing through Vermont. But they are a species that has learned to use structures to nest on, so they tend to nest on rooftops. Historically, I think they must have nested on the ground. But they are in what's called steep decline. They do, you know, they're, hopefully someday we will be able to bring them back to Vermont. But the listing happened relatively recently. And we have to, the state Fish and Wildlife Department has to sort of come up with a plan for how to bring them back to the state. But they are what's called an aerial insectivore, so they eat insects that are in flight. There's a number of species that are in that category, so nighthawk is just one of them. Swallows are another. And the aerial insectivores in general are a population that is not doing well. They're almost all of them are declining. So there's a lot we need to be thinking about when we think about how to help species like the common nighthawk.
Margaret, this is a seriously long trip for some of these birds. What kind of threats do they face during migration?
Well, there are a number of them. You know, Kira already mentioned sort of the light pollution issue. I know in some of the larger cities, especially the songbirds migrating at night, can get very disoriented if they fly near a skyscraper that's putting off a lot of light. So they can get very confused. And there have been several programs that are called Lights Out, where they actually turn the lights off during peak migration so that the birds can get reoriented. But they also strike buildings during migration, which is there was a big event in mid-September in New York City where a number of, I think it was over 200 birds were found. There's a number of citizen scientists that check for birds that hit these buildings during migration, and that was a very upsetting and disturbing event. So there's that. There's a other structures can be a threat. People's windows in their houses can be a threat, especially if they reflect to look like a forest through the window's reflection. The birds can't tell that it's a window, and they think they can fly right through it. There's lots of options for trying to minimize your window strikes by birds. Domestic cats are another threat during migration. Other predators like cats, but cats are one of the biggest killers of songbirds during migration. Pesticides, using pesticides to kill insects reduces food resources for a lot of these birds. So that can have an impact on their ability to refuel when they stop. And climate change. We don't really know how climate change is going to affect some of these species long term, but the shifting of the timing in terms of when insects are hatching or out and about may be out of sync with when the birds need the food. And then the stronger storms, just like I said, throwing off birds off course, or just large storms having an impact on their ability to migrate. So there's a number of threats, and there's lots that we can think about doing to minimize them. But it is a really dangerous time for these species to be trying to get from one place to another, and it's amazing that they do it, and then it's amazing that they come back.
Yeah. Wow. Kira, we don't all own skyscrapers, and we can't turn those lights out. But what are things we can do as individuals during the migration to help these birds?
So one thing that especially cat owners can do is keeping your cat indoors at this time of year, just because birds are more likely to be coming closer for food sources. So, reducing that threat. Like Margaret was saying with windows, there's lots of options that we can do now to help prevent that birds colliding into windows. So I know that there's lots of strings you can hang up in front of your windows. It's a great option just to get rid of the illusion that they might be able to fly through.
Mm-hmm.
And there's lots of resources online for that and what kinds of ways that we can make sure window collisions can be reduced. And then something else that we can do to aid birds on their migration journey is helping provide food sources for them, especially through plants in our yards, and kind of encouraging that we plant native plants for birds. And so Audubon has a great program, Plants for Birds, that you can find on audubon.org. There's a whole database to find out what native plants are in our areas that we can plant in our yards in order to provide that food source for birds on their migratory journeys.
Margaret, what are some of those trees or plants or shrubs that would be great for Vermonters to plant to help our birds?
Well, there's a number of them. They're what we call superstar plants, but in general, and if you go to Audubon Vermont's website, which is vt.audubon.org, we have a list of superstar plants, and these are the ones that provide both berry resources during migration as well as insect resources. So things like blueberries, elderberries, dogwoods, all native. We would only want to have native plants in our yards. Willows, oaks are really important for insects black cherry or any of the cherries are also great resources. And then if you think about some of the perennial plants out there that the seed eaters eat, like sunflowers, aster, goldenrod, there are a number of those as well. And one thing to think about, you know, some of the of our perennial gardens, like where we have bee balm or coneflower, those actually provide seeds in the off season. So not deadheading your perennial flowers that have seeds on them is also a great resource for the birds winter, you know, throughout the winter as well as during migration.
And Kira, would we have had to plant these types of things earlier in the year, or is now a good time to get them planted?
Fall is actually still a great time to plant, and especially before the ground starts to harden is a great time to plant. So there's still a lot that can be done for aiding birds on migration journey.
All right. And, Margaret, we have a couple minutes left. You know, I think I know what Audubon Vermont is, but I if anybody asked me, I probably couldn't answer. So what exactly is Audubon Vermont?
Well, Audubon Vermont is a state office of the National Audubon Society. So we are part of the larger national office, which has got state offices throughout the country. And we are just one of their state offices, and we also have 5 or 6 chapters in the state as well, which are associated with Audubon, but they are actually their own nonprofit organizations. So there's a lot of Audubons out there, a lot of different named Audubons, but in general, if you hear Audubon and then the state, we're part of a national Audubon. There are also independent Audubons out there, so if you Massachusetts Audubon is actually not associated with national. But we have about 3 different main priorities in our state office. One is conservation, the other is education, and the third is policy. So we have those 3 sort of general areas that we work in.
And what type of education opportunities does Audubon Vermont offer?
I'll let Kira answer that because she is an education expert.
Perfect. Kira, you have 1 minute.
Okay, great. We have a lot of school programs. We invite field trips to come through the Green Mountain Audubon Center in addition to programs that we offer on our own. We have preschool programs that come at our site twice a week. We have an elementary school program, and we have summer camps that come through. So we really do try to reach as wide of an audience as we can and really just engage everyone in the natural areas around us.
Kira, one specific bird you're hoping that you still might see during this fall migration?
Ooh.
It's the lightning round.
I guess just getting to see the tail end of warblers, and warbler ID in the fall is always something that's been a little tricky for me. So getting to ID warblers in the fall with their fall plumage is something that I'm still hoping to catch some of.
All right. Margaret, one for you.
I'll probably have to say similar to Kira, I really like seeing the warblers, the last stragglers go through, but I also really enjoy seeing American woodcock. They tend to be some of the last ones that go through, and I flush them when I take my dogs for a walk, and they pop out of the ground, and they're always kind of a cool bird to see.
They are indeed. Margaret Fowle is a conservation biologist for Audubon Vermont. Kira Fagan is Environmental Education and Outreach AmeriCorps member. Listeners, to learn more about the fall bird migration and about Audubon Vermont, you can visit vt.audubon.org. Kira and Margaret, thank you so much for spending this bird-filled hour with us.
Thanks for having us, Rick.
All right, take care. We're going to take a break for news, and when we come back, we're going to learn about solar batteries and energy storage. This is Vermont Viewpoint on WDEV.
Let our staff at the Warren Store ease you back into a pre-pandemic lifestyle. We can cater your postponed events and even bake you a custom cake. We can dress you in comfortable casual clothing. Make it a day trip for the best one-stop shopping in Vermont. Have lunch on our deck, head upstairs for some much-needed retail therapy, then treat yourself to a specialty coffee from our new espresso machine. You can pick up a colorful Warren Store beach towel for a dip in the river, and how about a delicious house-made ice cream sandwich? Fun, funky, safe, and friendly. Warren Store, Main Street, Warren Village, and warrenstore.com.
This is Vermont Viewpoint on WDEV. There's a lot of talk about converting to renewable energy to mitigate the effects of climate change, but there's an awful lot to learn about the various options that you might be considering for your home. That's why I like to occasionally have the folks from Green Mountain Solar join me so we can learn more about that particular option and to ask the questions that might be specific to your own situation. We're going to do that this segment and also focus on solar batteries and energy storage. We've got Jane Stromberg, the outreach coordinator for Green Mountain Solar, with us. Jane, welcome back to Vermont Viewpoint.
Good morning, Rick. Thank you so much.
Good morning. You're welcome. And Marcus Shapiro is their senior solar advisor. Marcus, great to have you back as well.
Yeah, thanks for having me again, Rick.
Sure thing. Now, listeners, if you'd like to ask our guests about solar power for your home, give us a call, 244-1777, 877-291-8255. You could also ask about your business. Jane, introduce us to Green Mountain Solar.
Absolutely. So we are a local owner-operated company in Vermont here, installing within a range of 2 hours from our office. We've got a team of about over 20 employees, and we serve residential, municipal, and commercial customers. We primarily install rooftop and ground-mounted solar arrays, as well as battery backup energy storage solutions. We like to help our customers increase their resiliency. And so we offer battery storage options that really ensure that their homes and businesses can continue to run on renewable solar power, even when the rest of the grid is experiencing an outage or a blackout.
All right. And Marcus, so we're in fall, heading to winter. It's just around the corner. Shorter days, less sunlight. So help me out here. Do solar panels still produce enough power for the needs of homeowners during this time of year?
Yes, they do. And so in the winter, there is definitely quite a bit less solar production than in the spring, summer, and fall. But that is where net metering comes into play. Where the idea is really that it's based on an annual period, and the idea is that you're actually going to overproduce with your solar system in the spring, summer, and fall. You send that excess production back to the grid and get a credit for it. And the idea is that you build up enough credit to last you through these winter months when maybe your home is using more power than the solar can actually produce.
Well, does it use more? I mean, obviously, the winter time when we're inside more, right? So we're using more power for more lighting, more heat. So would we still have sufficient amount of either power being generated or have net metered enough to get us through the winters?
Yeah, so when we do a site visit, we take into account a number of factors like the efficiencies on their roof and their annual electric bill, and we look to size the system such that we build up enough credits throughout the spring, summer, fall to last through those winter months. Because obviously in the winter months, with the short days we have, there being lots of snow and the sun being lower in the horizon, a lot of homeowners will use more power in the winter than their solar can produce. And so that's where the net metering really comes in to be able to offset all of the usage on an annual basis.
All right. Now, Jane, where does the battery come into play with a solar power system for someone's home?
So that's a very good question. And in Vermont especially, when you have these long winter nights, it's nice to know that you can rack up that energy that you're producing on your rooftop or on your ground-mounted solar array and have that be stored in your battery backup system that can either be in your garage or your basement. We recommend that it's, inside your home or facility to make sure that there's no fluctuating temperatures. It keeps the battery nice and healthy and lasts a long time. And so you can depend on this battery backup to power your essentials that you're going to need when, let's say, there is a power outage, or you're not producing as much power because there's a big snowstorm or something blocking the sun. So when you have that battery to rely on, you can power your lighting, your chargers, You know, there's these essential functions that you're going to need in your home when you're kind of, I don't want to say stranded, but quote-unquote stranded out there without power from elsewhere.
All right. Now, Marcus, let's get some maybe a little more technical on the battery side. First of all, how much energy can be stored for periods that, you know, Jane had kind of painted where there's low power generation or there's a blackout, we lose energy because of ice storm, something like that?
When it comes to sizing a battery, we work primarily with the Tesla Powerwall. And that system can be scaled with either 1, 2, 3, et cetera, and can be added to really figure out how many batteries are needed to supply enough power to someone in an outage. And when it comes to sizing a battery system, there's a couple of factors. If you have solar, one of the factors is how much solar you have and how much, and then you can size the battery based on the amount of panels that you have. The other consideration is what exactly you're looking to back up. And so for, say, like a critical loads backup, so like a well pump, your fridge, freezer, lights, internet, those kind of things, that can typically be done with 1 or 2 power walls. And then we get into the conversation of how much backup that homeowner is looking for. And so if they're really just looking for a buffer of a couple hours if the power goes out, all the way up to if they're looking for a couple days of backup, we can size the system such that we can meet those expectations of the homeowner. As each power wall is 13.5 kilowatts of backup storage and can be scaled up to really meet the needs of that homeowner.
Wow. And the other thing that Jane did mention was, you know, having it in a place where it can, you know, be kind of temperature regulated. So, you know, if you want to get more technical, you know, what does it take? How do you install these particular batteries for a home?
So we will typically install a battery storage system near the main electrical panel in the home. And so that typically, the best place to do that is in a basement area or in a utility room area, or if you have a heated garage, that's also a great place. These batteries don't want to freeze, though. If they go below freezing, it will most likely just shut off, but the efficiency of the battery does tail off quite a bit, anything below about 50 degrees.
All right. Jane, you mentioned the Tesla wall unit, but what types of batteries storage systems are available for your clients?
So absolutely, the Tesla Powerwall is one of those main options. We also install the Enphase battery, so that's another great brand that we recommend. They both are very, very good. It depends on exactly what our customer needs and wants in terms of what they want to spend and what their actual energy load is going to be. So it really comes down to that fine-tuned option decision-making that the customer is going to make. But we recommend both brands very often and just as equally as each other. So, yeah.
And Jane, kind of walk me through the steps of contacting your company to discuss a solar system for someone's home, right up through going online with the system.
Absolutely. So what we usually do is we'll get some calls or emails from folks that are interested in going solar. And so we will set up an appointment, a solar site evaluation appointment with one of our solar advisors. And we want to come at everything with a very holistic approach, right? We want to take everything into account. Everyone has their own specific needs and wants and situations. So we want to make sure that we're meeting all of those needs, goals, and requirements. So what we'll talk about is, you know, when our solar advisor goes out there, they're going to talk about current energy use. So having an electric bill handy is certainly helpful. We'll also talk about any changes in energy use that you can foresee as the customer. If you know you're going to install a hot tub or you want to get an electric vehicle, those are things we want to take into account for your system size. We'll also assess your site for solar exposure. So we want to know how much solar you're going to get at your property. And then we'll determine what the best options are for that customer to meet their needs. So that can look like a few different combinations of things, and our solar advisors walk through every single step of what that will look like. And then once something is decided upon, we process that in our office, and then we start scheduling an install day, and we'll have our team come out and do the installation for that customer. And then from there, it's pretty quick. From concept to completion, we like to handle everything on our side, permitting, paperwork, all that stuff. So we really try to take care of folks as best as possible.
So, Marcus, if I place the call today, and I'm not going to hold you to a specific number, but what's the general length of time from you know, starting that conversation, having you come out, take a look, installing, and then be flipping the switch and having the system in place?
So there's a number of factors that come into play, from the initial call to the office to actually having a system fully operational and commissioned. But typically, we'd schedule, once you call in, you'd be scheduled with a site visit with either myself or my colleague, Shannon. We would come out after the conversation that Jane just explained. We'd pull together a proposal custom tailored to your needs based on the conversation we had. And then if you were to give us the go-ahead and say, let's do this, we would look into sending a project agreement over to you and a small deposit. Then once we have that, we file the permit for the system and get the ball rolling on our end. And so permitting process with the Public Utility Commission is typically just 11 days. Mm. There are a couple towns in Vermont that have a longer permitting process of about 30 days or so. And then from there, it's really just scheduling the installation. And then it's just whatever lead time that we have at that moment, which does vary depending on the time of year. But typically, we're anywhere from about 1 to 3 months out from a decision made from a homeowner to the actual installation itself. That is for a typical residential install. For commercial installs, there can be quite a few more steps, permitting, engineering, and other steps that need to be taken to ensure that we're all good to go on the solar. And like Jane said, we really take care of every step of the process. So once you're ready to move forward, we'll install a turnkey system. And then once the system's built, one of the advisors would actually come out for a final walkthrough. To walk through all the monitoring apps, how to monitor your own system, walk you through any reset steps that may need to happen down the road, and do kind of a final touch point.
Mm. Let's go to Duxbury first, talk to Dee. Hi, Dee. What's up?
Hi. I am not – I'm concerned about what's in the batteries, what mm-hmm. they're made of.
Yep.
You know, I mean, it looks all, it sounds really good, but what do you do with them later?
Okay. Great questions. Marcus, what's in those batteries? And, the knock-on then, where do they go? How do we dispose of, recycle the batteries afterwards?
So the chemistry of the battery is somewhat dependent on the type of battery that you're going with. The Tesla Powerwall is an NMC chemistry, so nickel manganese cobalt chemistry, which is really energy dense. Those batteries were designed to be in the car, so they're very energy dense because of that. And the Enphase Ensemble batteries that we work with are lithium iron phosphate. And both batteries are very safe in the home. There's and so they both have there's tons of safety measures that they take to ensure that it's never going to have a thermal runaway situation or any type of safety hazards like that. With that being said, the recycle of these batteries, I'm sure that there is proper ways to recycle these, and I'm sure that industries will be coming about to properly dispose of these, as this is a hugely growing industry, both with electric vehicles and storage markets in homes.
What's the length of time, Marcus, that we can expect these batteries to be used before they would need to be replaced?
So both batteries typically come with a 10-year warranty, and depending on the charge and discharge of those batteries, they do have a certain degradation rate. But at year 10, these batteries should be roughly 70% of their day one capacity, and so there's no reason that it shouldn't last 15, 20 years. It'll just be a lower capacity than when they initially had started.
All right. Let's take another call. We're going to Middlesex this time. Talk to Ron. Hi, Ron.
Yeah, hi. Yeah, I believe you guys had installed Cumbergas several times to add to our system. First of all, I'm really very pleased. I'm not a fanatic electric everything fan, but mm-hmm. the batteries I'm renting, and I'm pleased we've, problem we had, but I think one of the controls went out over the summer, and that had to be fixed. But I'm very pleased with the system. It comes on so quick. When I have a power failure, you don't even know it kicked over.
Wow.
And I've been keeping a record since I had the batteries. I've had the batteries in, I think, like 2.5 or 3 years.
Uh-huh.
So if anyone's interested, I can give you the daily record. And I do have to say, you guys, on a yearly basis, I think you balance pretty close to our use. Now, on a daily basis, I mean, days I get almost nothing in the winter. But on a yearly basis, it seems to work out pretty well. So I would say if you don't have ridiculous expectations of the system, like running the whole house for a month or all that sort of stuff, it's great. And I'm renting because that way something happens to the battery, Tesla things. The biggest problem, and you guys have a little control, is trying to get through to Tesla when I had a problem.
Yeah.
It takes longer to get through to them, I think, and the batteries will last. But that's not your fault, you guys.
All right, Ron. Hey, thanks for that call. And Jane, you know, one thing Ron mentioned, you know, the usage. So is that how you do calculate it, on a yearly basis for someone, as you're going to install and kind of set up a system for them? You there, Jane?
Yeah.
Okay.
Can you hear me?
Yeah.
Hello. Okay. Yeah. So he brings up a really good point. Everything is based on a average. So we take a look at the electric bill, and the longer the history, the better. So sometimes when people are just moving into their new homes, they don't really have a history. So we can kind of, our ballpark might be a little bit more broad, but when we can see kind of month to month what, you know, people's usage are, especially throughout the winter, when things are a little higher, and then in the peak of the summer when you're really blasting your AC or something like that. Like, we want to see those peaks so we can add that to the average and make sure that we're sizing the system totally perfectly so it will completely cover that. That was a really good point he made.
Yeah. Jane, you know, we've been hearing a lot about supply chain slowdowns for so many products, especially in the construction industry. What is the situation like for the goods needed to install a solar system in someone's home right now?
So that again, is a really good thing to ask and talk about, because that is so prominent right now. We actually haven't seen, with the exception of some of our battery products, particularly with Tesla, we haven't seen too much of a slowdown at all. The one thing I will say, so we install rooftop ground-mounted solar arrays, but we also install carports and canopies, and that's built with wood. So we all know the price of lumber has skyrocketed. So that's something that's way more expensive probably than the actual datum line would be if we weren't necessarily having this global situation that we're in. So that's one thing that certainly is definitely impacting price on that front in a positive way. That's not really what we install the most of by any means. So we do a lot of residential rooftop solar systems, and in that process there's not a lot of slowdown on that front.
All right. Another concern, Marcus, of course, is workforce. Are you staffed to follow through on all of your orders right now in a reasonable amount of time?
Yes, we are 100%. And so our company has a really good retention rate of all of our employees. We have a lot of really dedicated installers and staff throughout the company. And we are also a very quickly growing company, and are adding people to both our office and installation workforce all the time. But we have been able to keep up with our installations, and we've actually expanded to 2 crews for the first time this year, which is really exciting as well, and also have a designated battery team that focuses on just the installation of batteries as well.
Now, Jane, as we're determining if solar makes sense for us economically, incentives are often mentioned. What, if any, are available to homeowners right now?
Sure, that's a great question. So, yeah, a lot of people in Vermont go solar to save money, keep energy production and use local, and to help the environment. And the money aspect, obviously, you know, it's not like a $2 system. So it's important to have incentives, and the incentives that are currently offered, the one main one is a 26% ITC, the income tax credit incentive, so that takes off a good chunk of that overall price for the system. We also, you know, accessibility and affordability is very important to us, so we also do, you know, to help people, we will do financing through VSECU, so there's a lot of different financing options on that front, too. With batteries and certain other kind of more specific parts of the system, there are a few incentives. And then I believe Marcus could speak a little bit more to that because we actually have a few new programs. I don't know if we have time, but
we do. We've got about a minute and a half, Marcus.
Okay, perfect.
Yeah, so as Jane mentioned, on the solar side of things, it's really the 26% federal income tax credit, which means you can recoup 26% cost of the entire investment based on your income tax liability. That also does apply to any battery storage system that is added to the solar as well, if it's done at the same time or within a year of the solar. Mm. And what a lot of what some of the bigger utilities in Vermont have begun doing is offering a battery incentive as well. And so Green Mountain Power, the largest utility in the state, and recently Vermont Electric Co-op, have rolled out these battery incentive programs that will essentially, they will give a rebate to a homeowner who has purchased a battery if the homeowner allows the utility to draw on that battery. And so whenever GMP, Green Mountain Power, or Vermont Electric Co-op has a peak charge from out of state or wherever they get their power from, they will then call on those residential batteries to bring down their own peak demands. And so that is a financial benefit to both the utility as well as the homeowner, and it makes the cost of a battery much more reasonable for a lot of homeowners. So it benefits the homeowners, it benefits the grid financially, and it also helps with the overall grid stability in the state as well. So by the utility having access to these residential power walls can offset a lot of the peak demand charges. And the biggest issue with grid instability is those peak charges from out of state, because those are typically the ones that are the least renewable and most harmful to the environment.
Marcus Shapiro is the Senior Solar Advisor for Green Mountain Solar, and Jane Stromberg is the Outreach Coordinator there. You can learn more at greenmtnsolar.com. Jane and Marcus, great having you on the show again. Thanks so much.
Thanks, Rick. Thank you.
You're welcome. Yeah. Take care. All right, let's take a break for a CBS News update, and then we're going to be back to learn about an organization called Vermont After School. This is Vermont Viewpoint on WDEV.
Let our staff at the Warren Store ease you back into a pre-pandemic lifestyle. We can cater your postponed events and even bake you a custom cake. We can dress you in comfortable casual clothing. Make it a day trip for the best one-stop shopping in Vermont. Have lunch on our deck, head upstairs for some much-needed retail therapy, then treat yourself to a specialty coffee from our new espresso machine. You can pick up a colorful Warren Store beach towel for a dip in the river, and how about a delicious house-made ice cream sandwich? Fun, funky, safe, and friendly. Warren Store, Main Street, Warren Village, and warrenstore.com.
This is Vermont Viewpoint on WDEV. There's this nether time zone when you're a kid, that space that exists between when you get out of school and when your parents get home from work. Sometimes you had activities like practice for a sports team or a club meeting, but all the other times that you spent unsupervised, you diligently got your homework done, you cleaned your room, you read nonfiction books that would give you a great head start on the things you'd learn someday in high school and college, or not. How valuable are those hours I just described, and how can they be used in a productive and or fun way? I'm joined now by Holly Morehouse. She's the executive director of an organization called Vermont After School, and I think she has some answers to these questions. Holly, welcome to Vermont Viewpoint.
Thanks so much. I really appreciate the invitation.
Oh, it's our pleasure. Listeners, to ask Holly about Vermont After School or to tell us, have you seen it work in your community? You can call us 244-1777, 877-291-8255. You can also email vtviewpoint@radiovermont.com. Holly, give us the big picture. What is Vermont After School?
After School is a statewide organization. We've existed since 2009, and as you said, we're really focused on that space outside of home and school. The reason we're focused on that space is, you know, we believe young people make a better Vermont, and they deserve the opportunities and programs and supports that will help them grow into happy, healthy adults. And we see that space is not just nice space to do something, but actually essential to the success. And decades of data backs that up.
When was it formed and to address what need?
It was formed in, the organization was formed in 2009, and it really was to acknowledge the data and research that was showing that that space outside of home and school, so it's that after-school space, it could be before school, it could be weekends, over the summer is really important. Yeah. And what the data and research was showing us is that young people that had the opportunity to participate in programs, to be active, engaged, connected, and heard, those young people did better in school. They had fewer risk factors. They stayed out of trouble. They had stronger relationships with peers and with supportive adults, and ultimately it set them up better for success. What we were finding was that access to those programs and spaces varied greatly depending on your family's resources and income level and where you lived in Vermont. Mm. And we didn't, you know, feel that to be acceptable. We feel it as a right, right, to have those opportunities that you need to succeed as a young person. So the organization was formed by a group of partners. Everything we do to this day, we do not do in isolation. It is really about partnerships, collaboration, really creating a movement that is about empowering our young people and giving them those supports.
Where is Vermont After School present in the state?
We, our offices are based out of South Burlington, but we do work with programs all across the state. In the last year or so alone, we have reached, we've worked with 89% of the towns in Vermont that have youth-serving organizations or programs. So we have a pretty far reach. We also do a broad age span, so we work with programs that are serving the children as young as, you know, 5 or 6 entering kindergarten all the way through youth and young adults in their early 20s.
Now, Holly, you have programs after school, summer, and something called Third Space, and I want to kind of go through each one. So give us an idea of what the after school program is.
So after school programs can be run by a variety of different organizations. They might be run, they might be school based and run right out of the school. They could be run by a Boys and Girls Club or a YMCA or a Parks and Rec Department or a licensed child care provider. At the elementary age, there's a lot of attention on creating that safe space, a place to be while family members are working. There's a gap of at least, you know, about 15 hours per week when children are out of school and family members, you know, are still working. We have parents who call all the time trying to figure out, you know, if they're relocating to Vermont or within Vermont, you know, where are the after school programs, because they can't work if they don't have a safe space for their children to be. When you move upwards into middle and high school, middle school is a lot about clubs and finding interests and passions. Middle schoolers also need a safe space to be, and it's right at that age where often child care supports and subsidies cut off, you know, or parents think, oh, you know, maybe, you know, the 10, 11, 12-year-old can stay home with the younger siblings. But that's the point. Right, you start to see the risky behavior.
Mm-hmm.
So,
yeah.
You know, that young adolescent age, we really want them right in. They need to connect with peers. They need supportive adults. They need to explore passionate interests. It's a really important time in their life for brain development, where their brains are either growing or, you know, parsing off, you know, synapses that they're not using. So we want to expose them to a lot of opportunities. So whether it's robotics or art or bird watching or hiking or kayaking, all of that is really important in that age group. And then in high school, it continues with exploration, career, college exploration, internships, looking at continue to develop the sense of self, strengthening your voice, self-agency, and then moves on up into the 20s.
And what goes on during the summer? What kind of programs do you offer for that, you know, stretch of several months? And, you know, their kids are kind of on their own, sometimes all during a day.
Yeah, so the summer is, you know, that is 10 weeks mm-hmm. that if we are, you know, serious about looking at what's going on with our children and youth, you know, we can't address any of the important issues if we don't look at that time. I mean, access to food, access to learning supports, safety supervision, prevention as well. We're really proud of the Summer Matters initiative that Governor Scott put forward this year, that Senator Sanders was a strong voice in support of as well with federal dollars. One of the most amazing things we saw with the Summer Matters initiative just in this past summer was this huge response from communities and programs and acknowledging that this summer in particular is really important, you know, in trying to help, you know, young people recover and come out of COVID and reconnect and focus on social emotional learning, and just how to be in spaces and in relationships together to play and explore. You know, part of what we saw this summer, even more so than before, was the variety of programs. I mean, we had science-based centers, you know, working with middle schoolers to actually build drones, right, and program them and learn to fly them. And we had, you know, traveling arts bus going around and, you know, working with youth to put on performances and learn to express themselves. And there was tons of hiking and maker spaces and adaptive sports and a real attention this year around that equity and inclusion, that access piece. You know, how do we make sure it's affordable? How do we make sure that children and youth can get there? How to make sure that traditionally marginalized populations, youth with special needs, youth who identify as BIPOC or LGBTQ, are also participating at equal rates in these programs. And I think Vermont took some huge steps forward and really intentionally looking at those issues, putting funding behind it, organizing a cross-agency team to pay attention to it, and really, you know, moving programs forward.
There's one more type of program, Holly, before we move on that I'd like you to explain. It's something called Third Space. What is that?
So Third Space is really a way to encompass that broad time range outside of home and school. So home being the first space where children and youth, right, develop and grow and learn. And then second space being school and the formal education system, which is so critical, right, to their growth and development. And then the third space really is everything else. So it's those after school and summer programs we're talking about, it's teen centers, it's scouts, it's, you know, whether you're, you know, able to, you know, visit museums, or, you know, go camping and hiking. When you look at, there's been some studies on teenagers and in particular and where they, their hours, right, during a typical day or week. And they find that about 80% of their time is spent in that third space, right? So maybe working a job or, you know, playing baseball or, you know, participating in drama or something like that. And what they're doing in that time really can help set them up for success or put them at risk. And making sure that all of our young people have opportunities in that third space, right, to be active, right, and engaged, right, so interested in something and engaged in it, which will carry over to their learning and to life, connected, reaching, you know, those relationships that are so important to how young people grow and develop and shape their identities, and then heard, which is the whole youth voice piece, and that needs to be strong throughout anything that we are doing in this area.
So what does it take? What's the process for you to move into a community to offer these services of Vermont After School?
So we really are interested in working with any program any organizations across the state, any communities that want to start an after-school program or a teen center. We do not serve children and youth directly, aside from a few Youth Voice initiatives that we're working on statewide, because we see the strongest way to do it is to work within the fabric of the community and help that community develop what is it they really need. You know, maybe they have already an after-school program that runs school year for elementary age students, and they need to expand to the summer months and then look at what they're doing for older youth. Or maybe they really are feeling a need for a community-based youth center that is a place where young people can be outside of the school and come and get resources and supports. They might have a YMCA or a Boys and Girls Club or a strong Parks and Rec department there. So we really try to work with the community to see what the need is of the families, to see what the available resources are, to identify where those gaps are in that community, and then figure out how we can expand the access in a way that will meet the needs of families and respond to what the youth in the community are saying that they want and need.
There was a report called America After 3 p.m. Can you tell us about some of the key findings in that report?
Absolutely. So that came out last December, and Vermont ranks in the top 10 in the nation for quality of after-school programming. It was a national study that was based on parents' survey responses and results. And we rank high for our quality, for parent satisfaction, for feeling that the children are and young people are safe and supportive and engaged in great activities when they're in an after-school or summer program. We did see our ranking actually drop. There was a previous report 6 years ago where we were fourth in the nation. And when you look at why we dropped from 4 to 10, which is still great, but we dropped because we have greater numbers. There's about 26,000 children and youth that would be in programs this afternoon if we had more of them and if they were more available and accessible and affordable. So our barriers that come through for being able to participate, they said there's often a cost in there that is blocking access that families can't afford. There is an availability issue depending sometimes on what town you live in. In some places, there's a lot of options in the summer, and in other places, there's one or none, or it's, you know, a half day. It's not going to provide the supports that are really needed. And sometimes it's a transportation, another issue that we really need to look at. So it's great to be in the top 10, really proud of our state. I'm really proud of the attention that the legislature and the governor has put to this issue. I'm really excited about where we're headed. But there is definitely clear evidence that there is work to be done. And I hate to miss even a year, right? I mean,
yeah.
First life, right? There's like such an urgency to it.
Yes.
Because you're like, where are they this afternoon, right? Yeah. And you can't make up that time.
No, it's an excellent point. Typically, Holly, where does the funding come from to get these programs started or to keep them going?
That's a great question. It's really a mix. There are some significant federal funding programs that Vermont does benefit from. There's some child care funding that helps with younger children, and there's some education-based funding that goes elementary, middle, and high school. Some of those are competitive grants that a community or school needs to apply for. There are also private foundations that help contribute funds. Sometimes schools are able to work money for a program into their local budgets. We also do rely quite a bit in Vermont on parent and family fees for participation, and I think that's where we really need to pay attention to the equity and access issue. For a few years, a couple years, we did have some state funding that was part of tobacco settlement fund that really helped expand access.
Right.
And in the current moment, there are the federal COVID recovery dollars that is helping to support such as that Summer Matters, the grants expansion that I talked about that happened this past summer.
How does a community start the process of working with Vermont After School if they want help in setting up a program or reviewing what they need or helping to improve the programs they already have in place?
They can reach out via our website. We have startup guides right on the website. We have staff who specialize in starting programs, staff who specialize in quality improvement for programs, Youth Voice, Youth Resilience curriculum and programming. They can email info@vermontafterschool.org or give us a call, 802-448-3464. And we are so happy and excited every time we hear from someone who wants to improve access for the children and youth in their community.
Holly, we have a couple more minutes left, but can you kind of give us an idea? I don't know if you want to point to a specific community or just give a general idea of a success story of how this works, you know, where a program that Vermont After School has helped to set up.
Oh, gosh. There's so many. We work with hundreds. You know, it's interesting to see there's different models, you know, in Burlington and Rutland, Springfield, they have some comprehensive programming that's based out of the school district and then partners with community partners, like King Street or Sarah Holbrook, in Burlington, up in the North Country, there is a system-wide effort to reach all of their elementary schools and make sure they have programming there. The summer program models have been, like I said, amazing. We've had so many, you know, from a photography studio to all kinds of arts organizations that have stepped into that space to make sure children and youth have access. Science centers play a strong role, maker spaces. It's really been exciting to see the variety. One thing someone could do if they wanted to find out more is, you know, visit our website. We do have blogs where we featured different types of programs to look for ideas there. I really think it's hard. It's not a cookie-cutter space, right?
It is,
and that's part of what makes it so amazing, right? It's about bringing kids in the community to kids, really opening up those opportunities. And then if you let youth drive your program, right? If you really do youth-centered programming, they're going to take it in directions that you wouldn't even imagine that are
right.
just going to be amazing for their growth.
Holly Morehouse is the executive director of Vermont After School. To learn more about what they do, you can go to vermontafterschool.org. Holly, thanks so much for being on the show today.
I really loved it. Thank you so much for having me.
All right. Thank you. That is our show for today, Vermont Viewpoint, directed by Danny McGivergan. Our email address, vtviewpoint@radiovermont.com. And listeners, if you've missed an episode of Vermont Viewpoint you want to listen to, download it. You can download the podcast at wdevradio.com, the Vermont Viewpoint podcast, sponsored by the Warren Store, funky, friendly, and almost world famous. We've got Common Sense Radio with Bill Sarah up next. Tomorrow, Bob Ney will be back. We're going to talk about picking your own potatoes, and we're also going to go on a Queen City ghost walk. I'm Rick Singeri. I'll meet you back here tomorrow.